As I mentioned, the next case is Rosemary Vandekar v. State of Nevada, case number 61649. Mr. Orem, I hope I pronounced your client's last name correctly.
Vandekar,
okay. Welcome. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Okay.
Your Honor, before I get started, may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Sure, of course.
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Orem. I'm the attorney for Ms. Vandekar. Ms. Vandekar had some unusual circumstances in her case. First of all, I think two of the issues, issue number one and issue number three, should really be considered sort of together and not taken separately in a vacuum. And that is, what we have is during the trial, there was a juror who was apparently nodding in and out. And the reason we know this is because two observers wrote affidavits telling Mr. Kane, who was the trial defense attorney, that they had observed the juror sleeping. And that the affidavits were then provided to the court. In an unusual fashion, one of the observers said, I've already told the marshal about this. At an evidentiary hearing, the marshal said he had no recollection of that occurring. But the judge noted that she was worried about the juror, worried that the juror appeared to be on medication, and that was because everybody noted this juror was in some type of cast. I wasn't trial counsel, but it's pretty clear from the record that she was in some type of arm cast. The judge also noted that the juror was closing her eyes a lot, and the defense moved for a new trial, and it was denied. And what is of concern about that is when you look at the Braun case, Braun versus Massachusetts, it discusses when a trial judge has a reasonable belief that a juror is sleeping, that the trial judge should conduct some type of voir dire and some type of hearing to determine whether the juror is paying attention. The affidavits and the evidentiary hearing showed that at least during a 10-minute period of crime scene analyst, that the juror appeared to be sleeping and going in and out.
Mr. Orem, as you have graciously put the facts in the best light for your client, the two parties that gave the information, I understand they were friends or associates of the defendant. Is that not correct?
That's true.
And additionally, I think, I'm not quite sure on this point, counsel for defense didn't raise this during the trial. He waited till after. And the judge did note and pay attention to this individual juror during the trial because likewise had some concerns. But we never had an attempt to query the juror during the trial.
That's correct.
Any explanation for that?
No, I don't have an explanation. So that's why I cite to Braun versus Massachusetts, because I think when the trial judge noted these things, the trial judge had noted this during trial, I think it was incumbent upon the trial judge to then inquire of the juror, is everything okay? Or, you know, you're hurting over there, you're on some type of medication, what's going on? Because, you know, she has a right, a constitutional right, to a sober jury, somebody who, jurors who are, you know, awake, alert, and listening to the evidence. Now, why I thought the issue should be dovetailed with issue number three was because in issue number three, which I think is a little more unsettling, and that is juror Michael McDonald is clearly a holdout juror for not guilty. And the reason we know that is because during deliberations, the foreperson comes forward and tells the judge.
Also, there's an admonition not to discuss this. He discussed it with his wife. That might be forgivable, but when he comes back and tells other jurors they haven't proven their case, doesn't that create kind of a difficulty in terms of following the instructions of the court?
Yes, it does. And as I point out in my brief, that's absolutely correct. There is the most minor technical breach of that admonition. And it is. There's no way I could argue against it. You're told not to discuss it. But this was...
That's the first part. But the second part, when you come back and recant that same position to the other jurors, how technical is that?
I think that's highly technical. And here is why. As I look at the standard that this court has given district court judges and the Ninth Circuit, I looked carefully at that. And when analyzing it, I don't really understand how it the technical violation should cause the juror to be removed. And also, Your Honor, I really want that weighed in an analysis to a juror who's sleeping. Everybody sees the juror sleeping. And that juror is not removed. But now everybody knows this juror is the holdout. And when we look at the Ninth Circuit standard, which is Dixon versus Sullivan, whether the material was actually received. Well, in this court, I have brought cases where I have claimed juror misconduct, where jurors have, one of them was at Zanna versus State that this court denied, and the juror had actually gone to church and done minor experiments where he had somebody sit on their lap and to see if he could get his hand in the child's pocket or something along those lines. This court said it was not sufficient for juror misconduct. And here, what we have is the most innocuous of statements. Yes, he shouldn't have said to his wife. I thought that the state didn't prove it. And yes, he shouldn't have come back in and said, I said to my wife that I didn't think they'd proven it. But under the Dickinson test, was this information received? Yes, it was received. The length of time it was available to the jurors. It was only a 5 or 10 second discussion. That's what the evidentiary hearing showed. It was a 5 or 10 second discussion. The extent to which it was discussed. Again, 5 to 10 seconds. Whether the material that was introduced before a verdict was reached, and if so, what point during deliberation? Well, it's just a very, again, innocuous. And the final one is, did it affect the verdict? Well, how does it affect the verdict? The man's already told the jurors he thinks she's not guilty, so the fact that he said, I told my wife, she's not guilty. I don't see how that should cause removal. And then, if we look at our own standard in our state under McKenna versus State, the court should look at the prejudice. And the prejudice requires an elevation or an evaluation of the quality and character of the misconduct. Is it that serious? Justice Douglas, I would argue it wasn't that serious. It wasn't serious enough to remove the juror. And whether the other jurors have been influenced by the discussion, maybe it irritated them, but how, it's not like he said, I went to a dictionary and this is the meaning and the judge has it wrong. And third, whether other jurors have been influenced by the decision and to the extent the misconduct could be withheld by that juror. Well, all you have to do is tell the jury, you shouldn't have done that. Why did you do that? Go back in deliberation. Don't talk about it again. But I don't think that that should have caused the holdout juror to be removed. And what results? An hour later, she's found guilty. And that causes me concern. And if you combine the two, why is the sleeping juror acceptable? When the defense complains about the sleeping juror, that's acceptable. But in this case, when the juror makes this one innocuous offhand comment, that is enough to have the juror removed. And that causes concern for Ms. Vandekar. And
you categorize the juror as if it's a fait accompli that they're sleeping, but yet counsel, at least my recollection of what was said, indicated he never observed the party sleeping.
That's correct.
That independent juror.
That's correct. That's correct. And obviously I'm not there. All I can do is rely upon the record. But, Your Honor, if the trial judge is noting it, what difference does it make? If the trial judge notes that the juror appears to be having their eyes closed a lot.
And I still come back to, I guess, the concern, and that is, the trial judge might have had a question, and counsel seems to say that they were aware that two individuals had some concerns but never raised it to the court during pre-deliberation.
Yes, I think he should have. He should have, but I don't think that should reflect badly upon Ms. Vandekar. And what's also of concern in Ms. Vandekar's case is that it's a unique set of facts in that Ms. Vandekar was convicted of, she's now 55 at the time, strangling to death a 6'4" man in her house. And when police originally respond to this case, they arrest her son. Her son was 6'5" and had just come back, I think, from Iraq. It's from some type of war. He'd been hurt with an IED, and he'd been confined for psychiatric treatment in Germany. Across his chest, he had red rum, and he testified the reason he had that on his chest is so that when he shaved in the morning, he could remind himself of murder and the things that had happened in Iraq. He was on OxyContin the night before. and police arrested him. He explained that he had scratches and bruises on his hands because of the handcuffs. And what the state is going to stand up here and say, and it's true, is during her recorded statement, after, at first she denies any involvement, but then she does make statements that could be construed as incriminating. I'm sure are construed as incriminating. And I can only wonder, when a mother is posed with a question where her son has been arrested, and now this sort of allegation, hey, there's only two people in that house, what happened? That the mother begins to retreat from her original position, I've got nothing, I did nothing wrong. But, you know, my time has come, but I would like to just finish with, that always caused some pause in this case because of her age and her size, and then the size of the victim. Manual strangulation is usually a form of dominance, or ligature. In this case, it could have been ligature. But it's a physical dominance, and that did cause some concern.
Before you sit down, Mr. Oram, and I'll add 2 minutes for you and for Mr. McDonald, I'd like you to address the expert DNA tests. I'm concerned about a Crawford violation, and I'd like to have you comment on that assignment of error.
In this particular case, the original analyst who tested the DNA, there were several belts taken out of the residence. They believe that a belt, maybe the ligature used. Christina Paulette conducted the test, and Christina Paulette was later terminated by the Metropolitan Police Department. To make a very long story short, she was terminated for falsifying or being dishonest on a particular test. And so what the state did is they called another analyst, Gunther, who testified that the conclusions of the DNA were similar between his conclusions and when I say his, I'm stopping because I'm not sure if it's a female, and Christina Paulette's. And so what I argued was, to me, that seemed like a Bullcoming violation and also Melendez violation, because they, on multiple occasions, said, yes, the tests were very similar. Now, if they want to put that evidence on, it is confrontation. And it's a confrontation clause violation. Put on Christina Paulette. They don't dare put on Christina Paulette because they know the cross-examination of Ms. Paulette is going to include, isn't it true you were terminated for falsifying evidence or falsifying a report, and that's going to look very, very bad for the state. So what do? They get that into evidence in sort of a back door way by saying, yes, I analyzed it, and when I analyzed it, it's just like the other analyst, and we came to the same conclusions.
Wasn't there a conclusion that they were different?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't there, on one of the items that was analyzed, they came up with different conclusions?
Very, very slightly. As I recall and as I quote in here, most of the conclusions were the same, and it was one belt that was Daniel Vandekar's belt that it came back as his DNA, and that possibly there was a mixture of DNA, but it was the same between both analysts. And that was what I cited in here. And now, when I come back up, I'll particularly pull up the site. But that was the concern, was that they were coming up with the exact same information, and they're using it by not putting on Christina Paulette. Have I answered your question, Justice?
Yes, thanks. You might think about commenting on, if it's a violation, why it isn't harmless when you return things. Mr. McDonald?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Justices, Counsel, good afternoon. Ryan J. McDonald, Appellate Deputy for the State. Just to start out, I kind of want to comment on, just as an appellate litigator, the quality of the record that you have before you. Because I think between the parties and the District Court, they made a really, one of the best records that I've seen, at least in a while. And one example of that is the record that the District Court made as to juror number one. When it came to the court's attention that he made this comment about 3 days before deliberation. And the District Court specifically followed the procedure that this court laid out and endorsed in the V. Ray case. It brought the, first it brought the foreperson in, who was the person who alerted the court to what the juror had said. The story that she related is that apparently in the deliberation room, juror number one said something about talking about the case with his wife. The court then brought in, I think, juror number two and was just going to bring in all the jurors and see what the communication possibly was, what the possible rule violation was, and assess any prejudice and whether it had contaminated the jury. Juror number two came in and said, yeah, I was sitting right next to him, and what he said was that he was telling his wife on Tuesday, deliberations were happening on Friday afternoon, he told his wife on Tuesday, I can't believe that this woman could have strangulated this victim. I don't believe that's possible. That's what juror number two told the court. Now, at this point, defense counsel says something like, okay, I don't think we have to bring in all 10 of them. She says, no, I'm going to bring in all 10. They bring in all 10. I think two or three heard some variation of the, I told my wife that I don't believe this defendant could possibly have strangulated the victim. The other ones weren't paying attention. They didn't really hear about it. They just knew that a comment was made. She brings in juror number one, and according to what she puts on the record, he's kind of dissembling. In fact, the judge calls his testimony, frankly, not candid. She didn't believe what he was saying. He wouldn't admit to any specific comments that he made to his wife, but did admit that he talked to his wife. She then said, this causes me concern, and the precise reason it causes me concern is because I've made this instruction 15 times. You all know, you make that instruction in the beginning when they first get there, and then every time they leave the courtroom, they hear the same admonition. And she was frustrated because she's made the same admonition 15 times, according to her, and he's still not listening. So when it comes to the end of this trial, is he going to listen to any of the jury instructions, or is he just going to go off on his own? So she decides that she's going to replace juror number one with an alternate, to bring all the jurors in and say, you're going to start deliberations anew, and then they start deliberating, and juror number one is discharged. That step-by-step is exactly the procedure that was laid out by this court in Viray. And interestingly, in Viray, this court cites as persuasive authority a 1991 California Supreme Court case called People v. Daniels. People v. Daniels is actually not only legally and procedurally on point with this case, but factually so. So I would urge you to read that as part of your analysis if you're interested in this issue. In Daniels, the defendant was somehow he had some limitation where he was confined to a wheelchair, and he shot and killed, the allegation was, two police officers. During deliberations, it came to the court's attention that a juror had previously, during the guilt phase, talked to his landlord and said, I don't believe there's any way that this guy can get out of his wheelchair and deliver the final shots to those police officers. The court held the hearing, same kind of procedure, replaced him with an alternate. On appeal to the California Supreme Court, the defense argued, look, this was error because there's no evidence that this guy completely made up his mind.
Mr. McGay, I think we're familiar with the Daniels case, and I hate to see you burning up valuable time explaining a case we've read to us. Seems unproductive. Perhaps instead you might address the sleeping juror question and the DNA expert testimony, where it does appear that there might have been overlap or improper testimony potentially by the DNA expert.
Sure, that's fine. As to the sleeping juror, I just want to correct something that Mr. Orem said. Mr. Orem said repeatedly that there were questions in the court's mind that this juror was sleeping. That is not true. That she did not say that. She said she noticed that juror closed her eyes. Qualification, she never thought, according to her observations, that the juror stopped paying attention. She did close her eyes frequently, but according to her, she was there, she never stopped paying attention, and that she noticed this juror specifically because during voir dire it was brought to the court's attention that she might need some kind of assistance. And at one point, I think that she asked the court to bring her ice because, according to the court, she was obviously in pain. So there is no evidence that she was sleeping. The only evidence that we really have is this affidavit. There's actually two affidavits, but one of the affiants said, "Oh, I saw her sleeping," and the other one said, "She told me she saw her sleeping." So we only have that one person, and said, and she affirmed that she went to the marshal and said, "Hey, that juror is sleeping." And apparently, according to defense counsel, she also approached defense counsel and said, "Hey, I think that juror is sleeping." For whatever reason, I guess defense counsel decided to wait until after the verdict was returned to bring this to the court's attention, and did it in a motion, in a post-verdict motion for a new trial, and said, "Yeah, I know, I understand, I should have brought it to your attention sooner, but she said that she told the marshal, so I thought she told the marshal," and no action was taken. So the facts pieced together don't really add up. She said, "I'm going to have a brief hearing." She brought the marshal in, and the marshal said, "I have no memory of this." I think this was about maybe 2 months after the trial, on August 2nd. It was either on August 2nd or May 25th. He says that he has no recollection of this person and that there's no way he would not have notified the judge if someone had said there's a sleeping juror. So I don't think there's any evidence that would be sufficient to question the district court's ruling on that issue. As to the DNA test, we specifically attempted to exclude any reference to Ms. Paulette pre-trial. It's the defense who wanted it, and that leads me to my major point, which is this has to be assessed for plain error, because there was no objection to this, because the defense wanted it in. In fact, they made it part of their closing argument. During their closing argument, they said, "Oh, we have this, we have an honest DNA expert who's the one who testified, and then we have this dishonest one. And the honest one is coming in here and telling me the tests are inconclusive, and the dishonest one is saying the tests were inconclusive, and the honest one is saying Daniel's DNA was on the belt." Because the theory of the defense, of course, as you just heard Mr. Orem say, and this was presented to the jury, is Daniel did it, Rosemary didn't. That was the theme of the entire trial from the defense perspective. So of course they didn't object to this, because they wanted that evidence about Paulette's involvement coming in. So there's a plain error component in, as a matter of strategy, saying that you want this evidence before the jury so that it's in the record and you can argue it at the end of trial, and then on appeal saying this was plain constitutional error.
Okay.
So the juror number one issue was the only one that was interesting to me, but obviously not to you. I want to note for the record.
Well, I don't know that you can make that assumption, counsel. The issue is of interest to us, absolutely.
Okay. I want to be in the appeal. There was nothing in the record. There were no exhibits transferred about the statement. All we have is the representations of the detectives about the statement. There is one part of the record where her handwritten statement is read into the record. That one page is missing from the transcript from the record on appeal. So I just want to note that for the record.
Okay. Anything else, counsel? You have added time if you wish to address anything. I don't have any questions.
No questions.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Orem?
I think I used up about 3 of my 5 minutes before, but let me make sure that I'm making correct representations to the court. The district court judge did not say that the juror was sleeping, and I found the quotes. The district court judge said she was worried she might be on medication. The court noted that the juror closed her eyes a lot. I thought I had made that clear. But the reason I thought that was important, because that seems to corroborate what these witnesses have said who wrote the affidavits, and Justice Douglas, you asked, aren't they friends of the defendant? I think, obviously, the implication there is that they're somehow biased. And so when I hear the judge make those kind of representations, it makes you, at least stands out that maybe they were being accurate in what they saw. And so that does cause me concern, and I hope all the issues are, as I see it, at least issue number one and number three should be considered together. I was asked to look at whether the issue of the Bull Cumming issue, the Confrontation Clause issue, was harmless error. The state, yes, the defense always wants to bring out Christina Paulette. It seems like a common theme. The DNA analyst has gotten herself in trouble, and so it seems like good impeachment evidence. Once it's precluded, why does the state then get to introduce sort of this idea that I analyzed it as an expert, and we've had this other analyst, and they've come up with similar conclusions?
Mr. Orm, there's a concern sometimes that defense is attempting to create error by not objecting, not coming forward at the time, and waiting till after to bring the issue.
As the state raised, unfortunately, the defense did not object. And so I do, as I wrote in my brief, I have to address this as and address with the court the fact that there was no objection. This was something I saw. And so I don't think it was, this was a public defender's office, and then when I was retained on the case, as I look at it, I'm going to raise the issue that I see. If there are no further questions, I can see my time is up.
Any additional questions? No, Mr. Orr, Mr. McDonald, thank you both for your excellent arguments this afternoon, and the case will stand submitted.